The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Yesterday, I spoke with the United States government former security advisor to President Trump, former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton. We spoke about the conflicts in Russia and Ukraine and also Gaza. He was talking about Gaza in the context of that announcement by Netanyahu not yet having taken place. We'll hear that interview in a few minutes' time. But first, as you have heard overnight, Israel's political security cabinet has approved a plan to take control of Gaza City as the country expands its military operation, despite intensifying criticism at home and abroad over the devastation of the almost two-year-old war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said yesterday that Israel intended to take military control of all of Gaza. The plan approved focuses specifically on Gaza City, which is the largest city in the enclave. Joining me now to talk about the viability of this particular plan is military analyst, co-host of the Red Matrix podcast, Sean Bell. Sean, good morning again.
Good morning to you, sir.
Now, let's talk about the plan to take over Gaza City, which they've confirmed will involve basically evacuating it and moving the military in there. How feasible is that?
Well, yeah, and virtually anything can be done, but you're not talking about something that's going to take days or weeks. This is months, maybe years to do that. First of all, Israel doesn't have the forces at the moment, so it's going to have to mobilize a lot of its reservists. They're going to need to have a bit of training. And already many of those are weary after nearly 2 years of war. The other thing is that you're incredibly vulnerable. You put a military into an urban situation like that, they can be picked off. You remember the Gaza Metro? We haven't talked much about that over the last couple of years, but you know that metro, that labyrinth of tunnels that Hamas has built underneath the whole of Gaza, that gives them the element of surprise. This has been extremely dangerous, extremely difficult, and a very costly undertaking. And it's not entirely clear to me as a military guy what the benefits are going to be.
Now, there was a very hostile meeting between Netanyahu or perhaps members of his cabinet and the head of the military. The military don't want to go ahead with this because they see the kind of attrition that will inevitably take place.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing that we tend to forget is that military is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. You have to have a political end state. And that's what the military provides the time and space to do. And it's not entirely clear to anybody at the moment what Netanyahu's end state is. He has come out with a list of principles for ending the war. And all of those are things like disarming Hamas, returning the hostages. But not once in there does he mention providing a Palestinian state. And the very raison d'etre for Hamas is to try to secure a Palestinian state. So whilst you have that complete disconnect, Hamas is currently an Islamic resistance movement. It's now been moved into an insurgency. History shows that militaries are not very good at countering insurgencies. So it's very difficult to see how this action is going to achieve any objectives that Benjamin Netanyahu claims. And as for the hostages, the only real viable way of getting the hostages out has been through negotiations so far. That's why so many Israelis are so concerned about the 20 that are believed still to be alive. This rather signs their death warrant.
Now, we know that the idea of Israel was to try and move as many Palestinians out of Gaza. They've made the place unlivable for most of that population at the moment in its current state. And yet they require the cooperation of other countries in order to achieve a mass migration of Palestinians who would reluctantly, I presume, leave the strip just to ensure the survival of their families and so on. But Egypt does not want a huge influx of Palestinians, and Jordan has already indicated that they will only go along with the plan that the Palestinians agree with. So what next? And by the way, when I spoke to John Bolton, he said he went along with Netanyahu's view. We should treat Palestinian refugees the way we treat any other refugees. We put them up in some other country until they can return safely to their own.
Yeah, I mean, you're actually trying to get me to help solve a problem that's been intractable for the last 80 years. And I'm certainly not smart enough to solve that in a heartbeat. What I would say is that in the absence of having a clear political vision, most international audiences think that it's a two-state solution is the only viable way forward. It's pretty clear Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't believe that. And therefore, it's easy to interpret what he's doing on the ground. We've been focused on Gaza. But Israel's been doing illegal occupations of the West Bank, gradually pushing the Palestinians out of the West Bank. It now seems to be applying more and more pressure on those in Gaza. There's a scene of devastation everywhere, a humanitarian disaster. You might be led to believe that this is all part of Israel trying to force them out of the Gaza Strip as well. The question then is, where would they go? And would that be remotely legal under international law? That's where you end up being at the limits of my ability to help solve it. But the core of it, you're not going to solve this particular problem with military action. It is a political process. And at the moment, Prime Minister Netanyahu's actions are signing the death knell for the hostages and making an already difficult situation in Gaza even more desperate.
Now, meantime, you have various agencies like Egypt and Qatar trying to continue with ceasefire talks and so on. And then Netanyahu, with his war cabinet, decides on this, which means to hell with any negotiations. We were only playing around. We weren't serious at all. In everything we were doing, we were just simply playing for time.
Well, I think at the heart of it, you can only have negotiations if at the core of it, you can come to some sort of accommodation. And I say, if you cut away all of the flotsam here, at its heart, you know, Israel was attacked on the 7th of October, heinous act, 1,200 people killed. But of course, their response, over 60,000 Palestinians have now been killed. Everybody's now bearing witness to the devastation in the Gaza Strip. If there is going to be a political solution, which is the only answer here, as I say, I reiterate, there's no military solution to this. You've got to get people around the table. And Hamas are absolutely want to have a two-state solution. They want to have a home for the Palestinian people. And it's pretty clear that Benjamin Netanyahu does not see that as a solution. Whilst that remains the difficulty, there would be no chance of any sort of negotiated solution.
Now, you heard in the remarks he made that they don't intend to, you know, be the military force keeping the peace in Gaza indefinitely, that would be done by an Arab force. I mean, which Arab countries would be prepared to pony up their young men and women to do this job?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tricky one, isn't it? I think what's been interesting about the language being used by Prime Minister Netanyahu, one thing I was looking for was occupation, and he did not use that in any of his statements. One of the reasons he didn't use that was because that puts legal obligation for the welfare of the civilian population. This is all a series of very clever use of words, trying to avoid getting Israel stuck into some obligation within the Gaza Strip. There is being deliberately vague about what countries might be involved, what that might look like, and timelines. And until you get some clarity on that, you have to believe that what Netanyahu is actually doing is just making life intolerable for the population of Gaza, forcing them to flee so that actually it can be taken over by Israel. I hope that's not the solution. But as you say, in the absence of having any other country, any Arab country prepared to discuss an alternative that's even been negotiated with Netanyahu, you have to believe that this is all to do with Netanyahu's own grand plan for Israel.
What's your assessment of the attitude of ordinary Palestinians, be they in the West Bank or in Gaza, to Hamas? I mean, Netanyahu seems to be of the belief, or is trying to peddle the belief, probably to Americans, that once you get rid of Hamas, that the rest of the Palestinian population will learn to love and live with Israel, which, you know, given what they've been through at the hands of Israel, I cannot see happening.
No, but it is a really interesting question because it's, you imagine, I mean, I don't live in Gaza at all. I've never visited Gaza, but you have to believe that it must be intolerable for the people in Gaza, and they must blame Hamas in some respect for what's happening. And the truth of the matter almost certainly is that Palestinians themselves, if you look back in the history of the last few decades, their life has been made more and more intolerable in the open prison that is Gaza. And Hamas has offered a way out. It's offered a chance to, how do we negotiate our way to a two-state solution? And bluntly, the Palestinians have been willing to take a huge risk and being devastated because they recognize that may be the only way to secure that future. I'm pretty confident that what Israel has to do politically is offer an alternative that is better than Hamas, offers the Palestinians a bright future, win the hearts and minds of normal Palestinians. That shouldn't be difficult to do. But it's pretty clear at the moment from the actions that are being taken that Netanyahu has no appetite for that.
I'm just wondering, when you say that, that you win the hearts and minds, when, you know, my family's been devastated by Israeli bombs, when I watch my children dying of malnutrition in Gaza, how am I to learn to love the Israelis?
Well, I you can't, can you? But I do think if you, as a father myself, your number one priority is to your family. And if you can secure a better future for your family. Now, these things are not going to happen overnight, are they? I look to sort of, there's various conflicts, even Northern Ireland. You know, that has taken decades to gradually get to where we are today. I do not think this is going to be solved in days, weeks, months or years. It'll be generations. But if you are going to create the foundations of a more acceptable future where people can prosper, families can prosper, there is hope and prosperity. It's a beautiful part of the world. It has great potential. But politically, people have to sit around the table, bash heads together. And it's pretty clear that Netanyahu's not going to do that. So what is the international community going to do, particularly Donald Trump, because he has many of the cards here?
Former fighter pilot, military analyst, co-host of the Red Matrix podcast, Sean Bell. Sean, thank you very much for joining us. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I spoke with the United States former security advisor to President Trump, former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. We spoke about the conflicts in Russia and Ukraine and also about Gaza before the decision was made by the security cabinet in Israel. But I started our conversation by asking John Bolton whether Trump's proposed meeting with Putin will take place next week and if it should take place.
Well, I think it looks like it will take place possibly next week. It has a lot of benefits for Vladimir Putin. He has not met with an American president since he met with Biden in Geneva in the summer of 2021, a meeting that many people thought led directly to the decision to go into Ukraine in 2022. Putin has been ostracized. He's a pariah leader. Now he's going to get to meet with the president of the United States. We don't know where. I suspect Putin would love to have it in Moscow. We'll find out soon enough. And interestingly, of course, all of the leaders of Europe will be excluded from the meeting. So Putin, I think realizing he has pushed Trump a little bit too far, will have a one-on-one opportunity to work his KGB training to try and bring their friendship, as Trump used to see it, back into line. Yeah, so from Putin's point of view, this is a real godsend.
Now, they did have a meeting before in Helsinki, and you and I actually talked about it and how shameful an episode that was, where Donald Trump seemed to take the word of Vladimir Putin over the words of his own security advisors.
Right. Well, I was there. It was pretty bad, that's for sure. You know, it's intended to find out what the thinking of the Russians is. Again, it seems to me this gives Putin a real advantage. He could come up with a quote-unquote peace plan that looks a lot like what Vice President J.D. Vance has said. You have a ceasefire in place, you put in a peacekeeping force, you know, maybe filled with Chinese and Indian troops under the UN. Ukraine commits never to join NATO, and that ceasefire line ultimately becomes a new border. So I think this is and then Trump has to take Putin's peace plan. Look at the optics here. Takes Putin's peace plan to Zelensky, who reacts how? He probably rejects it. So who stands in the way of peace in Donald Trump's mind in that scenario? So I think this gives Putin a lot of opportunity to make ground against Zelensky before Zelensky ever gets into the race.
Now, the noises coming after that meeting between Vladimir Putin and Steve Witkoff were that there would be something on the table. Now, what can the Russians offer? We know that Zelensky would like the bombardment of the civilian population to stop. We know equally that Putin would like the long-range missiles targeting his oil refineries to stop. Is that the kind of 50-50 offers that might be on the table?
Well, that's an offer for terms of a ceasefire. I think what Trump really wants to do is end the whole war, which is why I think Putin's likely to give him really terms of what an end state agreement would look like. But there's been reporting in the press about the idea of a ceasefire in the air. Remember, that would also include drones, which are critical for Ukrainian ground operations. And if all drones were downed, the Russian military strategy of just grinding out yard by yard gains against the Ukrainians would be facilitated. So it's very easy for Trump and others to say, we want peace, we want peace. Everybody wants peace. The question is, on whose terms?
Now, the question of whether Putin has always been playing Donald Trump, and before, I know when we talked about whether or not Trump was really a Russian asset, and I think your analysis was that, no, he's what the Russians would regard as a useful idiot. Is that still your view?
Sure. And I think Putin believes, rightly or wrongly, that that he can work Trump in the right direction. Now, we'll find out. It's obvious that Trump has had a number of negative things to say about Putin. You could call that education, but we'll see how long it lasts when they actually get together.
He did set a deadline, which was expiring this week, as to when the war should end. He gave that ultimatum to Putin, and then Witkoff was sent off to meet Putin, and we have this threat of secondary sanctions on India imposed immediately, and India is saying, no, we're going to keep buying the oil from Russia. We're not for turning on this. Where does that kind of standoff leave Donald Trump?
Well, I think that that it is right to try and convince India not to purchase Russian oil and gas. But the dilemma is, when you're in a complex strategic environment with a number of objectives and priorities, you have to try and sort things out in a way that tariffing India to punish Russia just doesn't do. The Indians are getting oil much more cheaply than they can get it from anybody else, and it's not illegal under U.S. and EU sanctions for them to do it, as long as they buy under the price cap that the G7 set some time back. And the Indians are saying that's all that we're doing. But even more important, as of this moment, there have been no U.S. secondary tariffs announced against China, which imports significantly greater quantities of oil and gas from Russia than India. And I'm very worried that unless the treatment is at least comparable, what Trump has done could have he didn't intend it, but it could have the effect of driving India back toward Russia, reminiscent of Cold War days, and even drive India closer to China, certainly when it comes to dealing together with the American tariffs.
Now, we know that Trump ordered the limitation of the amount of arms provided to Ukraine, and then they came up with this idea they would sell them to NATO, and NATO could then pass on these systems to Ukraine. The way to cause, I suppose, a stalemate in the war would be to totally and effectively rearm Ukraine, but that is probably never going to happen, is it?
Well, I don't see it on Trump's agenda. In fact, I don't see anything at the moment that Trump has proposed or that his administration has talked about that would force Russia to back away here. In fact, it's because Trump knows so little of the history here that he's entering these negotiations after having said repeatedly during the campaign that the war itself didn't make any sense. And he said earlier this week he called the war ridiculous. Well, the Ukrainians are fighting for their freedom and independence. I don't think most people would consider that senseless or ridiculous. And that's just something he needs to, at some point, understand.
But where we're heading, the way it looks at the moment, is Trump meets Putin. Putin works his magic on Trump. They come up with a peace plan, which they offer to Zelensky, and which Zelensky just has to refuse.
Yeah. If I were in Putin's shoes, that's the scenario I would be trying to set up. He's not going to tell Trump that he wants endless war. He's just not going to say that. He's not going to say, I'm not stopping until I conquer Ukraine, although I suspect that's what he would really do if he could. He's going to say, you know, Donald, you and I both want peace. I've worked hard at this. Here's my peace plan. Tell me what your thoughts are on it. But give this to Zelensky. This is a basis on which we can work. And I think Trump's likely to do it. And I think that puts Zelensky and supporters of Ukraine in a tough position optically.
Moving to the other theater of war, which is Gaza, and Trump articulating some concerns at the images, if not the reality, of what he was seeing on television of starving children. Is that in some way going to be a game changer for Netanyahu, that public pressure, both globally and from within the United States, will finally lead to a ceasefire?
No, Trump is reacting to pictures he's seeing on television, and he sees Israel criticized, and he wants to put himself in a position where he is not criticized. But he has also said, with respect to the possibility that Israel will reopen ground operations with the aim of finally achieving what they've said their objectives are all along, which is the elimination politically and militarily of Hamas, he said just a few days ago, that's up to the Israelis. So I think he's not worried about what's happening on the ground in Gaza. He's worried about his public image.
So how do you see all of this unfolding? I mean, the unless there's massive influxes of aid into Gaza, you know, the limited aid that's going in will be fought over. There will be people dying simply out of desperation to get food. The killing will continue. How do you see this evolving?
Well, I think it will continue. And I think a big part of the problem here from the beginning, even before the October 7 barbaric Hamas attack on Israel, is that for years, Hamas has controlled the distribution of food, medicine, other basic human needs inside Gaza. And there's been press reporting in the United States about how their loss of control over the food has caused them a significant decrease in revenues. So this is really about control of the population. And the difficulties of distributing the humanitarian assistance in ways that don't subsidize Hamas.
What did you make of that letter sent to the White House expressing concern over what's going on in Gaza by members, former members of Shin Bet, of Mossad, of the IDF, and some politicians saying, look, there's no strategic military objective anymore. We need to get the hostages back. And the way to do that is to talk and have a ceasefire.
Well, I think they're wrong. I think as long as Hamas continues, as long as Hamas holds part of this incredible underground tunnel network in Gaza, which they do. There are tunnels, there are areas that we don't even know how big they are that the Israelis have never gotten to. As long as that fortress remains even partially in Hamas hands, the risk is that they're going to come right back. And I look at the analogy of World War II, where continuing its long tradition in these matters, the U.S. under Franklin Roosevelt said our objectives in dealing with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan could be satisfied only by unconditional surrender. So if you want to end the war, ask Hamas to surrender.
That's probably not likely to happen. But the question is,
well, if Hitler had been unlikely to surrender, would we just have said, I guess we just can't go on, can we?
I'm just wondering whether or not effective military occupation and safe military occupation for the Israelis is possible of Gaza. I mean, eventually what gets to populations is when they see the body bags coming home with their own soldiers in them. That's what gets to populations, and that brings political pressure.
Well, I don't think the Israelis want occupation of Gaza. And I think what they want is the elimination of Hamas. And then what comes next really depends on not just Israel, but what the rest of the world decides to do. I mean, I think what needs to happen here is that instead of all the years of UNRWA being the UN presence in Gaza and the West Bank, it's time to treat the Palestinian refugees the same way we've treated every other significant refugee population in the world since the end of World War II, and that's to use the principles of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, put them in charge of the Palestinian refugee problem, and see if we can't find either an alternative in Gaza or what UNHCR frequently does when a refugee can't return to their country of origin, they resettle them.
And the question is, who will take them in? Egypt demurring, Jordan demurring, but...
Well, can we just stop on that question? Why won't the Egyptians take the Gazans in, at least? Is it lack of money, or is it fear that many of these people in Gaza are Hamas sympathizers, and Hamas is a subsidiary of the Muslim Brotherhood?
So they would be afraid of bringing in a fifth column into Egypt?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that is the Egyptian and perhaps Jordanian objection. And that says, well, so why in that circumstance is it now a burden on Israel when the Arab states themselves worry about what to do with this population?
Finally, Ambassador, the whole question of who's running the show in the White House. I mean, so who is actually calling the shots, whether it's on Gaza, on Ukraine, on tariffs, on trade?
Well, I don't think anyone is, and I think that's part of the problem. I think Trump wants everything centered on him. So For example, the National Security Council process, from everything I can see and hear from the inside, is completely broken. And I'll be the first to concede that the NSC process is not perfect, but it's designed to rationalize decision making in the national security space for the president, given the breadth and complexity of the affairs he has to deal with. And when that's not there, you could say either nobody's running the show, or every subordinate in every department is pursuing their own agenda, which leads to confusion, chaos, and possibly real danger.
And are you embarrassed when the likes of Steve Witkoff is sent off on a very sensitive diplomatic mission?
I don't know. I wouldn't send a divorce lawyer to do brain surgery. I don't know why they're sending a real estate dealer to negotiate with Vladimir Putin or to try and deal with the Middle East either. The one virtue Witkoff has is absolutely 100% loyal to Donald Trump.
Ambassador John Bolton, thank you very much for joining us on our program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.